Lech Lecha, Vayera Chayisara. Dramatic names. I missed last week's share, so I have to get it on, get it on online. But the third parsha sounds a little anticlimactic. After Lech Lecha, departure, you have to walk away from the past. We talk about this a lot now, this period. You can't move forward in life unless there's a departure of sorts. A lot of people are afraid. They never let themselves progress or advance in life because they're always afraid to change, to let go of parts of their past. You're not trying to turn your back on your past. You're not trying to sever yourself from your past. You're not going to snub your friends. You're not going to be mean to people. That's obviously not the derech of avodas Hashem. But to move forward in life, you have to walk away from some of the things in your past. You can't continue everything, all the same friends and all the same practices and all the same. Change means you don't just transform it, take everything, but change sometimes means lech lecha. You walk away a little bit. In Vayera, we spoke about Avraham Avinu encountering HaKadosh Baruch Hu, first in the house of Mamre, Bris Mila, and then on the Har Hashem, on Har Moriah. And Chayisar is what Avraham realizes that there's also family to take care of. That with all the Har Moriahs and all the Akedos and all the making history, you're not taking care of your children, you're not burying your wife, you're not worrying about your household, and you have a person. And I didn't get a chance to tell you this last week, but be careful, because the next couple of years, you're going to be making very, very faithful decisions. And you're going to be choosing which profession, you're going to be choosing who to marry, you're going to be choosing how much money to make. And if the only thing in your mind is, how can I change the world around me, then there's something wrong, because you're half a person. And the question ultimately has to become, am I a good parent, am I a good husband? It's always more seductive, more exciting to be a big, fill in the blank, rabbi, teacher, lawyer, president, superstar, rock star, change the world, whatever. And at home, you're just another stinker. Take out the garbage, change the diapers. So a lot of people, well, it's great, they're very attracted to being those public figures who everyone adores and everyone showers with approval and awards and they're honored at the dinner and everyone knows what you've accomplished. And the real challenge, the real heroism is just to just be a great, great father. I said this to my shiur on Friday. I'll repeat it again. If anyone wants a copy of that 25-minute version, so I can send it to you. I have it online. But they just interviewed Rav Lichtenstein about 2 weeks ago. He was honored by YU. Thousands of people came, and they interviewed him for the Jewish press, and they asked Rav Lichtenstein. This is Rav Lichtenstein. Tens of thousands of Talmidim. Biggest Hesder Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. Talmud of the Rav. Countless Svarim. Milton. Rav Lichtenstein. They asked him, what are your proudest of all of your accomplishments in life? And he said, the family I've raised. Could you believe that? So anytime you have a question in your life about how to divvy up your time between being the greatest all-star, all-pro, all-world, fill in the blank, and just spending time at home, sometimes I hear, oh boy, he's the greatest Rebbe, he's in the Beis Medrash around the clock. No! No, it's not the greatest Rebbe. The greatest Rebbe is the Rebbe that's home with his family at night. That's his homework at night. That's cleaning up from dinner at night. That's living with his children at night. That's being there for his family. If the Rebbe's already older, then of course it's a, if the Rebbe doesn't have children at home. But, if there's a Rebbe who has children, oh, what a role model, what an example. They're always around. They're always giving shermis. No, that's not the role model. That's not the example. And that's Avraham's balancing, Avraham's correction. It wasn't his fault that he was on Har Moriah when Sarah died. It's not his fault. That's just the reality. He can't be in two places at once. Vayava Avraham, the Spodus. This is just a quick 5-minute capsule of Vayisachar Yisara because I was in Memphis of all places. But, okay, aside from Jonathan, it seems as if Yitzchak gets an unfair shake. Avraham has three Parshios dedicated to his saga. And it's a neatly packaged trifecta. Departure, encounter, rendezvous, Vayera, and then domestication, Chayisar. It's a beautiful three-part trilogy. Yaakov. The story of Yaakov dominates the entire second half of Sefer Bereishis. Starting from Vayetze, and again, 5, 6, Vayetzev, Yishev, Vayetzev, making 6 Parshios. All centered around Yaakov and his children, because after all, the face-off between Yehuda and Yosef is really about Yaakov's legacy. So it's Yaakov and his household. Beis Yaakov, Bnei Yaakov, El Bnei Yaakov. Yitzchak, one itty-bitty, teeny-weeny little parsha inserted in the middle as an afterthought. How come Yitzchak gets the raw end of the deal? How come Yitzchak gets the short end of the stick? Avram, 3 parshios. Yaakov, 6. Yitzchak, 1. And it's not just one parsha, but it's an anonymous parsha. All the other parshas have such dramatic names that reflect the voyages, the challenges, the heroism, the activities of each of these avos. Yaakov Malachi, Yaakov and the angels. Yeshiv Yaakov, Eretz Megri Aviv, Eretz Kanan. These are all powerful, dramatic, flamboyant words describing the avos. And Yitzchak's parsha, the one parsha he receives, the only parsha he receives, and told us Yitzchak ben Avram, because he was a child. He was a child, and these are his children. And you can see Yitzchak waving his head and saying, "What about me? Can I get a little more airtime? Does anyone care about me?" Sarcastically. Does anyone care about my life and my experience? I get one parsha, and my parsha isn't really named so dramatically. And the parsha begins, Eila, source 1, part Aleph. Eila, toldos, Yitzchak ben Abraham. So this is my parsha. I only have one parsha, Tanya. I got one parsha. Let me tell you what I did. What did I do? First pasuk. Avraham holidus Yitzchak. That was Avraham's son. We know that. We know that in parsha Yisar. We know that in Vayera. I don't have too many psukim here. The few psukim I have describe me, my activities, what I accomplished, what I pioneered. Eila toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham, these are the, whether toldos means children literally, or as Rashi sometimes says in Brachos, these are the activities, these are the impacts. Either way, imagine on your tombstone, when they put down all of your accomplishments, these are the accomplishments, and remember, we only have a few lines. He was born by to so and so. No, you normally look prospectively, progressively. What did he accomplish? We already know about Yitzchak's birth. After all, it was prophesied, and the angels, no one's going to forget this. It's not as if we don't have documentation. We have plenty of psukim. And we're returning to psukim. So something is eerie, guys. Something is a little strange. Something is a little different when we reach Parshas Toldos. The style shifts. The story is diminished, is shrunken into one parsha. Yitzchak's identity appears to be submerged or even subjugated to Avraham's. Avraham holed is Yitzchak. And the truth is, if we look at the parsha from 10,000 feet up, before we get to specific psukim and specific midrashi chazal, we do sense that even this one parsha that Yitzchak merits, it's a little different. It isn't dramatic, first of all. The only one of the avos, probably the only parsha without malachim. If you think about all the parshios, and all the malachim or apparitions or encounters, even in Parshas Chayesara, Eliezer, Hakri na malachi lefanecha, he has malachim that he senses goes ahead of him. And of course, Vayetze, and Vayishlach, Yaakov malachim, and Vayetze with this, it's always encounters with supernatural beings, and all the parshios surrounding Parshas Toldos. Toldos is very, very terrestrial, very pedestrian. No malachim, and no malachim. Not just no malachim, but hardly any malachim. Hardly any kings and wars, and a little bit to do with Abimelech, but very, very little. Far less pronounced. And the lack of international diplomacy and encounter with foreign rulers is merely a product that Yitzchak doesn't really travel anywhere. The lack of encountering other people is not just incidental that he traveled and said, "I'm here, let's fight it out, let's duke it out, let's make history." He didn't go anywhere. He stayed in Eretz Yisrael. He stayed in Gerar, Yitzchak Begrar. He remains in one location. So of course there's not going to be any dramatic encounter. The most dramatic thing that happens in Parshas Toldos is a few wells get stuffed up and he has to redig them. It's like the big song and dance about a few wells. When Avram is fighting wars and saving the world and challenging to find justice, and Yaakov is dreaming of Malachim, Yitzchak, it's the wells. So I'm obviously adding a lot of humor to it, but one thing after another, it seems as if the entire drama of this narrative screeches to a halt. gets me screeching to a halt. And something changes in Parshas Toldos. It's a little boring. It's a little displaced. His identity is a little supplanted. So before we even look at Pesukim, we sense trends. We sense certain movements in Yitzchak's personality. One parsha. And that parsha is very undramatic. And even the parsha isn't even primarily drawn by Yitzchak. Most of the parsha is being driven by people who are manipulating Yitzchak. Basically, isn't even in the driver's seat, narratively. It's Rivka planning, and Esav delivering, and Yaakov, quote-unquote, deceiving. He isn't the primary author. And it's Rivka who goes to ask the people, why there are two children, and why she feels such, so to speak, cramping, or labor pains, or pregnancy stress. And everything is being driven by people around Yitzchak, and then figuratively and literally, Yitzchak is actually blinded, but he's probably blind figuratively well before. He's not really authoring most of the action. Remember, Yitzchak not only has one parsha, which isn't named after him, which begins with tracing him to Avraham's son, which we know already, so it displaces his personality. But remember, Yitzchak's the only one of the Avos who doesn't have two names. Every one of the Avos undergoes a name transformation. And a name transformation isn't just incidental or capricious, by the way, change your name because you're a CIA agent on the lam, but the name changes are reflective of transitions in life. Avram transitions from being an Avram to an Avraham, an Avraham Algonian. And his new name reflects that. The naming is resonant. The naming is historical. The naming is symbolic. Yaakov transitions from Yaakov to Yisrael. Ki sarisa im elokim banashim vatuchal. Guys, we'll talk about this in Mirat Hashem and Vayetze. Yaakov is the Gullistic name. Yaakov is the name Jewish people have in Gullus when they struggle, when they're clutching the heels of history, struggling to reach their place in history. Yisrael is the triumphant name when the Jews are redeemed, when we defeat our enemies. Ki sarisa im elokim banashim vatuchal. That's what we say every morning. Matavu ohalecha Yaakov mishkin asecha Yisrael. When we're in Gullus, all we have is an ohel. We're in Eretz Yisrael, we already have a Mishkan, which is relative to Ohel, much more permanent. So Yaakov triumphs. He escapes the struggle of Yaakov and he becomes Yisrael. Of course, the struggle continues, but that's the sign of the Jewish triumph, Yisrael. So every one of the others has a new name. Heck, Yosef has a new name. He becomes Sotkas, Panach, and Avrech. There are plenty of names in Bereishis. And Yitzchak never changes his name. He has the same old, tired, stale, boring name. Could you imagine? Only has one name. And not only that, Daniel. All the other Avos, their name based on their identity, activity, whatever. How does Yitzchak get his name? Because when he was born, they were all laughing. Imagine Hillel if your parents called you corn chips. Hey, corn chips. Because when Hillel was born, we were eating some corn chips. You know, what about me? You know, if God gets up to the press and they want to say, I hope my son will be so and so, I hope my son will be such and such, we'll do so and so. No, Wayne ain't in Rice Krispies. He was born, it was breakfast time. Hello, you know, do I get my own? I'm making it humorous. No one's really laughing, but finally, Megan would be laughing. Megan, there's obviously something afoul. There's something different. There's something intentional about this Yitzchak, and whenever there's something intentional, there's a hidden message. And now, with all that introduction, with the seven or eight mayas, one parsha, introduced by Avram's son, name based on other people's responses, doesn't travel, no malachim, no malachim, no name changes. Now let's read the only section in which there's some, look at my fingers, or my eyebrows, drama. There's a little bit of drama, because there's a famine, and for Avos, famines are not just chances to find food, but challenges to respond to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's nisyonos, and you'll come into contact with other people. Remember Avram, twice famined, Metaro and Avimelech. So finally, Yitzchak, this is his one shot. This is his only moment to stand out and be one of the Avos. Now let's read about that one moment. Vayhi Ra'av Ba'aretz. So finally you can imagine Yitzchak rolling up his sleeves. Okay, now I've got my family. Here I go. You ready for my family? Well, here's my shot. I've been training for this. Training for this for my shot at being an Av. Hi Rav, Ba'aretz, Source Gimel. Milvad HaRav HaRishon Asher HaYavi Me'Avram. But this wasn't the real family. This is just part two of Avram's famine. No, no, no! This is my famine! Can I even have my own famine? Stop it already! This is my famine! Stop taking away my famine! You famine stealer, you famine thief! It's my famine! Milvad HaRav HaRishon Asher HaYavi Me'Avram Avinu. So what does Yitzchak go? He goes to Gur. That's his big chiddush. I'm going to find a solution to this thing. Right where his father went. So Hashem asks him not to go, and he doesn't go. He meets Avimelech a little bit later. So Hashem tells him, stay where you are, don't travel. Okay? Because I will multiply your children, because I will support you, because this land is yours. He gives them, this is Yitzchak's only famine. And this is Yitzchak's only bracha. This is Yitzchak's only time. Avram gets countless brachas. Yaakov gets countless visitations. This is it. This is, okay, Hashem, give me my bracha. Tell me I'm doing well. Give me a pat on the back. So Hashem says, okay, the herbaceous zaracha kechoch v'ashamayim, v'nesatila zaracha, source gimel, es karetz ozeel, es baruchuv zaracha, kol goyei aretz. Why? And Yitzchak is waiting for the compliment. Pasuk, hey. Because Avraham was great, because Avraham listened to me, because Avraham fulfilled my mitzvahs. You know, Hashem, thanks. I was waiting for that compliment. I'm doing it for you because of your father, and I'm saving you from your father's famine, and you don't even exist. You know, when I was in yeshiva, so my chavrusa was actually a father of a boy learning in yeshiva now, whose name will go unmentioned. He's not in this room. And that boy's father was best friends with Rav Lichtenstein, Mikadma Dinav, from, you know, the old days in 1820, you know, way, way back when. So Rav Lichtenstein used to come over to our makom literally every week and check on. That was his friend's son. So he'd come over and check on him, and you come in for Shabbos, and you left your shoes there over for Shabbos, and I brought you some peanut butter back, and your parents say hello. And I'd be sitting there, hello! What am I, chopped liver? I didn't know my name, who I was, whether it's coming or going. All these kind of, and I felt like Yitzchak. I didn't know I felt like Yitzchak. I didn't know this Bar Tara yet, but reading this Bar Tara, that's what I felt like. Hello, am I anything? You know, my chopped liver. So all of a sudden, Yitzchak, and the pasuk continues. Hashem visits him 20 seconds later. Vayere lav Hashem b'leilahu vayomer anochi lokei aram avicha. Doesn't say lokecha, lokei aram avicha. Al tira ki itcha anochi. Again, you know, in the humorous side, rubbing it in. Avraham. Avraham Avdi. Hello? Do you remember that Keda? From my neck? Was my neck on the line? I was about to be killed. It was me. I did something. I'm indominating to you. I stay in Earth Israel. A little sus. Nothing. Ekev Hashem Avraham. Bavur Avraham Avdi. Okay, so not only does Yitzchak have a famine, he's got another test. He really has two tests. Famine, and then he's got to work things out with Avimelech when he goes to the coast. He doesn't leave Israel, but he goes to the coast, to Aza, current-day Aza, the five towns of the Plishtim, southern coast. So how do you think he solves the problem that his wife is attractive? He's going to come up with a new idea. So what does he say? Vayishalu anshei makom, it's the middle between Gimel and Dalet. Vayomer achosihi. I'm going to come up with a great idea. She's my sister. Where did we hear that one before? Who tried that one before? Avram. Same trick. Same disguise. Same ruse. And of course, it explodes in similar fashion. So now Yitzchak just can't escape it. It's imposed on him. He follows through. Perachav Gimel. A little bit out of place. Again. We'll read that a little bit later. And then finally, most tellingly, source Dalet. The third part, really, Yitzchak has three basic issues he faces. A, to leave Israel and Hashem says stay. B, to visit Avimelech and protect his wife. C, when he fights with the servants of Avimelech who close up the wells and he has to dig wells again. So this is part A, part Dalet. Vayeshev Yitzchak, vayachpor es beres hamayim, asher chafru bimei Avraham aviv, they've closed up the wells, so instead of digging other wells, He opens up the old wells, which you can kind of, it's just easier because the ground is soft and moist. Doesn't dig new wells, just goes back to the old wells, digs the same wells, but most notably, Avnil, Vayigdol lehem shemos, he calls them names, Kashemos Asher Karal Maviv, the same names. He can't even think of a new name. I say this, obviously, out of humor. Of course he can. There's something up here. And Chazal take all of this, everything, from the name, from the one parsha, from the fact that he doesn't even drive his one parsha, from the introduction to the parsha, from the way Hashem gives him a bracha, from the fact there's no malachim, and no malachim, and the rules is the same, take it all together. And they say, source number Vav, Avraham Nikra Avraham, Avraham was called Avraham, it's a medrash, Yitzchak Nikra Avraham, Yitzchak was called Avraham. How do you know that Yitzchak was really called Avraham, whatever that means? The Chsiv, the Eila told us, Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham. Yitzchak's name is Avram. It's a play on words. Eila told us Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram. You know who Yitzchak was? He was Avram. So now you're convinced of something here. It's not just a little raya or dia that I'm saying on Sunday night just to give you a mussar shiur. No, there's something here. There's something here. Watch it. The answer is as follows. The answer lies in the difference between the French Revolution and the American Revolution. Let's get to it that way. Don't worry, America. You know, they're getting scary. He's starting to make fun of the Europeans. He's going to get back to English. French Revolution was a revolution that never ended. When a new paradigm is introduced into human consciousness, a new way of thinking about things, I don't mean a new restaurant down the block, a revolution of consciousness where people see their world differently. Copernicus, Darwin, maybe unfortunate revolution, space travel, Avraham Avinu, monotheism, liberty, democracy. When new ideas are introduced to the human mind, paradigm shift, revolution of consciousness, those periods have to be followed by subsequent periods, not that are revolutionary and creative, but the period after a revolution. I don't mean a political revolution. Most political revolutions is just switching one. I mean real revolutions, mental revolutions, have to be followed by periods of entrenchment so that people become accustomed to seeing the world that way, to thinking that way, to behaving that way. You've got to take ideas and entrench them. And the French Revolution was a revolution that continued to revolve. Excuse the pun. And today's heroes were tomorrow's victims. And Robespierre was the great leader, and 20 years later he was guillotined. And Jean-Paul Marat was a great, you know, 20 years later, as the mob was unleashed, he was stabbed in his bed. These are revolutions. It was never, it left a vacuum because people aren't accustomed to republic and fraternity and constantly changing and adapting and readjusting and altering, and nothing sticks. The vacuum is created, not a shift. But the old is washed away, and nothing new replaces it with solidity and stability and depth. And then any vacuum allows totalitarian, and that's when the economy rises. The great miracle of the American Revolution is that rebels and fighters became statesmen and crafters of the Constitution, of the way of life. They were to lay down their swords and create. America became what it is, for better or for worse, because of 100 years of peace. And as Europe was bleeding itself dry through countless national wars of nationalism in the 1800s, America was isolated because of their doctrine of isolationism. And it just took those ideas and rooted them and entrenched them, and they created a new way of life. And this is not jingoistic, this isn't page, this is just historical. And there are problems with it. Of course there are problems with it. But Avram introduces a bold new way of viewing their world. The world is at a clock. There's a moral spirit. There's a creator. That creator could be discovered, but can't be seen. That creator is transcendent, not imminent. That creator has moral will. Stop sacrificing each other. Stop murdering. Stop moral decadence. There's life. There's principle, and those principles are worth sacrificing for, because you're involved in an endless pursuit of an infinite moral will. And even if you have to sacrifice your son and lose everything, There's eternity. There's an eternity that's beyond this world. The religion is a thrust into another realm, and men just aren't trained to think that way. And what will happen if his 70 or so years of revolution, let's assume he starts his revolution at the age of 70, 75, and he lives 100 years of revolution, are followed by Yitzchak reinventing the wheel and pioneering and developing new ideas and new parshios and new apparitions and new encounters. Nothing from Lech Lecha and Vayera will stick, and it won't be lost. And Yitzchak's gevura, it takes inner strength. It's always easier to be a revolutionary. It's always easier to be different. It's always easier to be an inventor, to be a person of change, and bring a message of change, and rage against the system, and be fiery, and different, and to be Che Guevara, to put on your shirt, and to try to rebel against the system and the establishment, and I'm different, and I have new music, and it's always cool, it's always attractive, it's always boring to be caught in the shadow of your ancestors, and no one wants to be old and stodgy, and I'm just following the people before me have done, and I'm a traditionalist, and I'm stuck in the system, my voice is stifled, and I'm a free spirit! I hear that one more time with Kuma. I'm a free spirit! I need to stretch my wings! These stupid metaphors. I'll tell you, just embrace it, get your attention. Sometimes you gotta just take ideas and move them. And deeply, deeply live them and consolidate them. And it takes incredible strength to be someone like Yitzchak. Because no one will know who you are. Because you're not gonna have mountains and angels, kings and trips and drama and fighting and name changes. And it's gonna be boring. It's going to be repeating your same steps again and again and again and again. And you're never going to leave Gar. But you're going to be a hero of history. Because you're going to take Avraham's message of monotheism and of morality and root it. And that's the message that Parshas told us. You're not going to have your own Parsha. You're not going to have your own authorship. You're not going to have your own name. You're not going to have a name change. You'll be called Avraham because your purpose is to take Avraham's legacy and just entrench it. That's what makes you a hero. And that's the lesson that Parshas told us. Now, how do you take that lesson to your own life? I was just being sarcastic before. Of course, you're free spirits, and of course, you have to create. But life has to be a blend. And sometimes that blend is periodic or episodic, where there are moments in life where you do create yourself in your new worlds, and to a degree, you should all record this Dvar Torah and listen to it later, because to a degree, 18 to 27, 28, really is the period in your life which is revolutionary, which is meant to be different, which is meant to be a game changer. And I'm the agent of change. How many times have I pushed you not to be cowardly, not to be stuck in your cultural mores, think out of the box. Not to just sheepishly go through this year and say, I am who I am, and my aspirations will max out at the highest tolerable levels that modern orthodoxy allows for me. So I'll just go to a college and be a nice, firm Jew and move on. Rage against, riot against, say, well, can I be different? Because obviously you can be different, because obviously there are higher levels, because obviously if you just take mediocre formulas, you'll just be mediocre. And who's going to be the future Talmidei Chachamim of our world? Who's going to be the future Torah leaders? Who's going to infuse us with spirit? Who's going to labor for redemption? Who's going to change morality? Who's going to teach Torah? Who's going to suffuse Shas in our society? And he's about to let the next guy, I'll just go into college, get my degree, and let everyone else deal with this world's problems. I don't mean this world's problems, I mean HaKadosh Baruch Hu's problems. Those are eternal problems. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's problems. Who's going to deal with it? Who's going to change the state of Torah in our world? Who's going to change the state of davening in our shuls? Who's going to change the state of religion? Who's going to turn religion to something which is an accommodation and a convenience and something which is a passion and an obsession? You know, let people around you do that. Well, once you walk down the path of cowardice, you're condemning yourself to a life of mediocrity because you just take a pass and defer to others. Someone's got to stand up and make a difference. Someone's got to stand up and say, there are problems, I'm going to relate to them. I'm going to sacrifice convenience and luxury because there are issues that I want to deal with. That's me talking most of the time. And that's you living 18, 19, 20, 25, 26, 27. But then at some point, generally, something has to shift. And then I'll talk about even now. I'm not going to, this is not just the share when you're 27 or 28. But how about taking who you've become and just locking it in and becoming magnificent and excellent? Magnificence in any sphere is a product of repeated, boring, repetitious efforts again and again, doing the same thing again and again and again. And that's the ADD syndrome. That's our ADD, ADHD syndrome in our world. That we don't have focus. We're unable to focus in on one thing and repeat it. We're constantly diffusing our energies. Our attention span is diminished. And Steve Jobs is the great hero, the capitalist baron, and the great villain of modernity, because he revolutionized the way we entertain ourselves, and he took away our focus and attention span because we're constantly flipping to the next screen, figuratively. And we're unable, I don't just mean the attention span per minute, but in our mind's eye, change is good, difference is exciting, adventure is appealing, and repetition, that's just boring. And how quickly can I get the next phone, the next app, the next hairdo, the next style, the next show, the next movie, the next sports, the next. And we just don't have that ability to hone in and focus on that one experience and make it last. Time. We think we have more time because we're more organized. We have less time because our schedules are more full. We have less time to focus in on particulars. So all of a sudden, you have to be able to find that ability to shift. Find that ability to focus, okay? A lot more focus in life, guys. You have a lot of noise in your world. Can you focus in on the moment? For mindfulness and focus. So we have the ability to, at that point, maybe inhale, maybe ask something. Relocate, okay? Maybe relocate. We have the ability to hone in and become a Yitzhak in your life. And you see people, we call them in our world people that never grow up, they're constantly changing. I'm still 40 years old and I still haven't decided what I want to do with my life. And that's something that you'll say in a commencement speech. You tell the graduates not to be so anal and not to be so focused. And I'm still 45 and I haven't. Chalila v'chas, you should be 45 and still haven't decided what to do in your life. Because decide what to do and do it great and do it for 60 years. Or do it for 50 years and do it great. Doesn't mean you should never change. Doesn't mean you should be stagnant. Doesn't mean you should crawl through a hole and obviously be dynamic and over change. But that groove that you settle into to be great, you have to find it. And again, don't make rash decisions. Don't be impetuous. If you make poor decisions, you can change decisions. But ultimately, the sense that I'm constantly reinventing and constantly from place to place. In high school, very often, you live from exciting point to exciting point. What's the next exciting thing in my life? What's the next game? What's the next time at the restaurant? What's the next sports event that I'm excited about? What's the next movie? And all the time in between is just the parentheses. I'm just, till I get to the thing that I'm really going to enjoy. I'm working for the weekend. How much of our culture is just bearing with it, holding your breath, tolerating the burden of the week till you get, don't ever live that way. Don't ever live out of time. Don't ever live, I don't like what I'm doing, I don't find meaning what I'm doing, I'm just waiting until. Chalila v'chas. That's just throwing away time. That's an empty way to live your life. Every minute should be filled. What can I do? How many hours do I have today? And how can I fill them with meaning and accomplishment or whatever? Don't say, I can't wait for the day to be over. I can't wait, you know, my most painful moments experientially in life when I find myself in moments that I can't wait for time to pass. Like when a plane where I can't work and I can't, I said, I'm waiting. Such a terrible, terrible feeling to be counting down to my own death. To be giving away the only resource I can never recover. If I spend all the money I have in my bank, there are ways for me to recover those resources. Maybe harder, maybe easier. But in theory, if I really prioritize recovering that money, I'd go out and work harder, get a triple job or something. I can recover everything. I can say, I'm sorry, someone's feelings have hurt. The only thing I can never recover is time. It's just purely a waste. Every time, minute that I let slip by, I will never recover. So I'm just letting the time go by when you're not feeling well and you say, I can't wait to go to sleep tonight. Sometimes you have that feeling. It's a bad feeling, not just physically. It's painful. It's painful to be caught in a time trap where you're just waiting for time to pass rather than saying, okay, what can I do next? What's the next thing I can do? What's the next mitzvah? What's the next thing I can do productively? What's the next person I can help out? What's the next block gemara? What? Rather than just passing time and waiting for it to relapse. If you ever find yourself in such a situation, get out. Find meaning. Reorient your life. Don't let time just, don't let your life pass you by. So that's part of the challenge, is to be able to go from being 18 to being 30, and some people just never have that ability to just go home every night, same house, same community, same show, same wife, same children, same stale meatballs, same leftover food from Shabbos, same clothing, same everything, without having to always change. It's a very thin balance, because you don't want to be stuck in stasis, but you also don't want to be an addict to change and to adventure and to excitement. You know, sociologists have said that most adulterous affairs take place 7.5 years into a marriage. They call it, you may have read about it sociologically, 7.5 year itch. Because after 7.5 years, sexual relations are no longer exciting, there's no longer mystery, you're no longer involved in the hunt and the capture of a different, you know, and therefore you start feeling that itch. And sex is supposed to be adventurous. I mean, when you're young, there's an element to that itch, and you'll find that. And obviously, in our day, we view sexual relations as positive and healthy and spiritual nourishment. And again, don't get caught up in this. The Rishonim didn't view it that. The Rishonim viewed it as bestial, subhuman, and purely reproductive. And sexual mores have changed. I don't know which is better. I don't know which is true. I don't think there's one truth. There are different sociological systems, and you have to be a product of the world in which you grow up in. If you live in the 12th century Spain, you follow the Rambam and the Ramban, that was bestial. But you live in the 21st century England, South Africa, Israel, America, and in our world, this is seen as a spiritual or an emotional encounter with the soulmate, a way to communicate in a nonverbal fashion, and as long as it's done by Kedusha Vatara. But, you know, oh, it's boring. So it's supposed to be to trigger your attention level, to trigger your excitement, adventure. It's supposed to be a way of bonding with someone. What is marriage? You spend your life with the same person, and you discover new parts about that person, to be sure, and the relationship evolves, but basically you build. You see people that have been married for 50, 60 years, some of you look at your grandparents, and you see what you've built. You know, and the greatest tragedy of a divorce is that you don't build anything. Whatever you build, you break. And the greatest tragedy, to be honest, today, where people are orthodoxizing, have to face homosexuality and how to deal with more people who view themselves as orthodox, that are trying to keep mitzvahs and are trying their hardest, and they just don't feel, and on a personal level, your heart goes out to those people, you know, trying their hardest, and you certainly shouldn't say anything negative or insulting. It's an issur to, but on a communal level, it's sad. It's just sad that person won't have the chance to build. I mean, I feel like I'm part of building something. One day, when I sit at a Seder, when I'm 70 years old, and it's Hashem, Hashem lets me live and sit before, you know, 50 people, 60 people, and not most of the 60 people. I remember reading in an article a few years ago, an article about a Jew in Meir Shearim who died when he was about 102, whatever. So he had children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, even great-great-grandchildren, whatever. They said that when he died, he had something like 1,300 blood descendants. Not 1,300 people at the Seder, 1,300 people with his DNA, aside from their spouses. Okay? 1,300 people, if you do the math, based on Haredi family planning, it's not so hard. 20 times 40 times 20, you get to whatever pretty quickly. You just do a quick mathematician. Okay? So that's obviously not the way we plan our families, but I'm not saying this to make fun. I was just astounded. I was just so moved by that. That without changing the world, without, you know, winning the Nobel Peace Prize, without, he just brought 1,400 incredible people, as best he can, to this world that had blood pulsing, his blood pulsing through their veins. That was an exciting moment for me. I'm happy he was dead, right? Yes, it was just an affirming moment. That's what I want to do. That's really what I want to do. You know, maybe different numbers, different percentages, but more or less, he's my hero. Between the time he died and the time he was buried, in that 6-hour window, whatever, 12-hour window, there were 2 bar mitzvahs, 3 weddings. He didn't even get to be buried before his family kept growing. Before his Yotzei Chalatza were able to go, that's an incredible notion. That's just an incredible notion, which, by the way, there's a hidden message here. One of the things that has to change, one of the things that you have to alter in your mind is, yes, we live after the Holocaust. Yes, we're trying to rebuild our people. Yes, we're trying to resettle our land. Don't fall sheepishly to the 2.1 kid family planning that Western culture preaches. I'm not telling you how many children to have. It's based on resources, financial resources, marital resources, psychological resources, physical resources, the whole spiel. And no one looks unkindly on people that can't have more children for whatever reason. But your aim should be, your goal should be, how many children can I have? How many people are going to bring it to this world? Fundamental difference between the way Western society views the period from 20 to 50 and the way we view the period. 20 to 50 in Western society, you're young, you're strong, you're at your prime, you're handsome, you have it. Go, earn that money, get the new car, part of the gym, sculpt your body, spend your time, go on vacation, Alaska, Spain, venture, go. And I don't think that's Tara's message. Tara's message is you're prime. Raise children, teach them, nurture them. New car? Take a look at my car. My car is a broken down jalopy. When's the last time you vacation? Take a short little 2-day vacation every couple of years with my wife just to get us a breather. So you have more time or less time to have big biceps. Okay, so it's not the most important thing of the biggest biceps in town. Or, you know, that's what happened there. Those are the questions. What are we talking about, guys? We're talking about you. So even here, guys, even here, okay? It's not just when you're 27, 28, but now. That's so much part of the shift in yeshiva, because high school really is a lot of the Avram-like patchwork quilt, especially in America. I don't know what it's like in England. I don't know what it's like in South Africa. I don't know what it's like in Detroit. But in America, in America, that's what high school is. On the debating team, and the basketball team, and the basket weaving team, and the lacrosse team, and the mock trial team, and the debate team. And by the way, that's why, unfortunately, there's a tuition crisis facing. Because in our day, we learned, and we took our courses, and we had stale spaghetti for lunch. But today, we're going to give our kids the entire package. So of course it's going to cost $75,000 per semester. And of course, there's going to be a crisis no one can afford it. So if you ask me how to solve, not being an American high school educator, but if you ask me from a side point, so cut it out. So we won't have the French debating team to debate in French. And we won't have the volleyball team. You know, you can still go to Olam Haba without having a volleyball team. Don't worry. Hashem's not going to ask you, where is the volleyball team? How come you came in 22nd place in the mock trial? You know, there are things that are more important. The Yiddish and the Shambles. So you know how Torah we're teaching and the values we're conveying. I think we have to have a little contraction. I think it's an epidemic, or it's reflective of like, we can have it all, Shmuel. We can have it all. Our kids can be Orthodox, and we can have it all. So to me, that's a very, very, that's what I'm looking for. Deceitful message, deceitful or illusory message. You know, in life, you can't have it all. You can have it all if you're really, 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 really mediocre in everything. If you want to be excellent in some things, you got to shave off and focus. And that's not a religious voice. That's a voice of just simply massively investing resources by focusing and concentrating them. Okay, you can have it all. Just be really, really, really tepid. Really, really flaccid in everything. Or you can burn, but to burn in something, you have to massively invest whatever that is. Whatever that is. It could be relationships. It could be intellectualism. Certainly it should be religion and power values. But you can't really have it all. We should stop shaping our worlds based on the illusion that you can have it all. We want to be broad. Maybe it's a time to contract a little. Maybe the financial pressure isn't such a, it's a terrible thing in a general sense, but it leads to a little contraction, a little focus. What's important? What do we shave? What do we keep? Now all of a sudden you're in yeshiva, and that experience, listen guys, that experience now is changing up on you. You know the recipe for success November 21st, tomorrow? The recipe for success November 21st? One simple recipe. I'll give it to you straight out. How many hours can you spend in that one room? And the rooms associated with it. And you're not going to run to this meet and to this track and to this game and to this restaurant and to this mock trial and to this and to this and to that and to that. How many hours can you spend in the Beis Medrash or in this camp, this building? Not in your room, not in your shalayim, not in the basketball court, unless you have to. I'm saying, you need to, of course, or you need to relax. But the focus is, how can I be the most? What can I do? And try to condition yourself that way. A good, good exercise for November 21st is, okay, I can't learn 14 hours a day. I'm not there yet. But how many of those 14 hours can I just be in the game, be part of the action, be part of the environment? If you're in your room, you're on the side. If you're in the Beis Medrash, learning, talking, schmoozing, sleeping, eating, joking, walking, daydreaming, you're in. You're part of the enthusiasm, part of the energy. If you're in your room, you're out of the rhythm. You're putting yourself on the sidelines. Sometimes you have to be on the sideline. No one's going to pull you off for the sidelines you're missing starting. But the more that you're in the game, the more plays you're going to make. The more you're going to be part of it. The more rhythm you're going to get. The more, so I call it the base matters bum. The challenge of November 21st is to become a base matters bum. The goal is to be a big Talmud Chacham and learn a lot of Torah and have a change or a Avodas Hashem and Yiddishkeit. But if you're not there yet, get there by becoming a Beis Medrash bum. Just hang out. Hang out in the Beis Medrash. You know, some of you talking to each other. Someone comes out of the wine, you're learning, say, Rabbi Tarragon told me not to learn. Okay? I've learned with the best of them. I can tell you a roster of who my chavrusas are. They're literally all the Rebbeim in this yeshiva, some of the Rosh Yeshivas of this yeshiva, including Big Rabbanim, and one of them is a Big Rabbanim than the next. We would sit there and talk all day long. Not all day long, but we talk and schmooze, and that was part of life in Beis Medrash. Yes, you guys call it the hak, to be part of the Beis Medrash hak, to talk and schmooze about life, and you're never going to have this. This is your chance. You're never going to have a situation where you've got all these people looking for meaning, more or less serious, focused on the same value system, and go in and put yourself into that Petri dish and grow. The rest of your life, you're going to be at odds with your surroundings. I hope you are. I hope you're not going to be in harmony with your surroundings. There's going to be dissonance. When's the next time in your life you can just throw down your defenses, jump into the deep end of the pool and say, whatever values are being professed by the institution, meaning institution is everyone, you're obeying them. Obviously, people voicing ideas that aren't healthy, but the basic value system, that's great. Open my heart, pour it in, suck it up, and absorb it. Never. You're always going to have to make your own judgments. So if in your room, you're on the side. You're not part of that. You're not, obviously, you need time off, think, distill, let things gel. So how do you go from high school to Beis Medrash? How do you go from Avraham to Yitzchak? From Har Moriah and Shem and Eloni Mamre and Be'er Sheva and Malachim and bang, 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 staccato bursts of excitement to just sitting in a boring room. Tomorrow, you know what I get to do? Oh, getting daf yurches. That's not much different than today. Well, what did I get to do? Getting daf yurches. And what's tomorrow? 7 o'clock davening. What was yesterday? 7 o'clock davening. It's the same fog and the same weather and the same bad jokes of Rabbi Tarragon, and nothing changes. So we're trying to change it up a little bit, and we have differences and things are shifting, but that's all the curtain, behind the curtain. The real life is the life of Rav Lichtenstein, the life of, you know, the next one, just doing the same thing. Rav Amital, Zechron and Levracha, would tell us that there's a machlokas in the Taras Kohanim. What's in the Sifra? What's the most important pasuk in the Torah? So what did Rabbi Akiva say? And what did Ben Zoma say? Different pasuk. Not morality based on sympathy to friends. You have to have a kamacha, but based on Selim Elokim, Bidmus Elokim. Pasuk in Bereshis. But there's a variant version of the Sifra, which says the most important pasuk in the Torah is? Zekeves, you've heard this before. Taseva, Boker. Zekeves. Most important pasuk is a pasuk describing Shmuel, the carbon tumit. The carbon tumid, that's what excites you? The same fashtunken of carbon every day? Two sheep? I mean, carbonos are exciting. Maybe not, but it can be exciting. 7 of this, 2 of that, 14, 13, flour, and then we get into some of the more exciting carbonos, the mitzora, oil, wine, birds, one gets killed. A lot of excitement in carbonos. A lot of differences. But the Talmud, same exact Ashtunkana sheep, morning and evening. As Akemez Achata said Baboka, as Akemez Ashanita said Ben Arbayim, that's the most important pasuk in the Torah, a boring pasuk? Yeah, that's the most important pasuk in the Torah. It all starts with, can you just be someone that just repeats day in, day out without fearing boredom? Listen to what I'm saying. Fearing boredom. Modernity has a word for the fear of boredom. It's called ennui. Those of you who took your college entrance exams, E-N-N-U-I. Ennui means existential boredom. Waiting for Godot, anyone read Samuel Beckett? No? Did you everything? Ennui. Just, you know, modern man is still searching for meaning. The two world wars collapsed, ancient models. Everything was washed away. And we don't really know, people don't really know what's at the heart of humanity now. And instead of facing it, it's just easier to entertain yourself into escapism. Then, you know, what do you stand for? What do you live for? What are you on this earth for? What's your goal? So it's easier to relieve the burden of that struggle, that exploration, by just surrounding yourself with 24 hours of entertainment, of sports, of movies, and movies on demand, video on demand, music on demand. So I don't have time to think about larger questions. to listen to the song for the 17th time, or watch the dunk for the 14th time tonight on SportsCenter, or watch the replays of the football match for the 10th time, but they're not going to change. Rather than face, that's where society is stuck. 2011, we're stuck in this rut. It wasn't true in 1811. 1811, you interviewed people. What do you live for? What's your purpose? It may have been faulty systems. I live for Christianity, or I live for pay, but there's something clear focus on what I live for, what my life is oriented towards. All that washed away. Have you ever read Kafka? So he sensed it happening between the two world wars. That's what made him such a powerful spokesman of humanity between the two world wars, as he sensed that the world was in chaos, was swirling into a different place, and man wasn't yet prepared to face it. And all these isms that we're going through, communism and Thatcherism and Reagan, the world is still resetting itself. What is the world about? What's the next? I think pretty much, Al-Qaeda and Islamic fundamentalism is shaping things into focus, a face-off of sorts between two worlds, between the world of Judeo-Christian values and a world that supports life and a world that celebrates death. And more or less, I think things are coming. It's hard to know. It's hard to see to the future. But that's the challenge of Parshas Toldos. How can you go from being an Avram into a Yitzhak? You don't have to be the revolutionary. You don't have to fear boredom. You don't have to find the next big thing, as our culture says. What's the next big thing? And by the way, this is from someone, may or may not be, I certainly try to be, very creative, never stuck in neutral, always looking to change, always looking for a new paradigm. So I'm not some stodgy old professor of chemistry with a goatee and a pipe, walking in and saying, oh, the new generation, you're all spoiled. When we were your age, we all grew up in a shoe and we ate pasta for dinner and you're all spoiled brats. And I understand the pulse of the modern world. I understand the pulse of change. I think, I hope, and I'm taken by it. I think it's important to be powered by it, to change your world by it, to change other people's worlds by it. I fashioned myself, maybe yes, maybe not, as an early adapter. In the early 90s, I sensed the internet was something that would really, what's this thing called the internet, people would say, it'll probably just fade in a couple of years. This is here to stay, it's going to change our world. I started writing Shiurim, and I've written close to 500 Shiurim, tech Shiurim. My goal is to reach 1,000, to write 1,000 Shiurim when I'm in this world. Hopefully I'll have the strength to, or the time to. These are things that I get a sense can change our world. I'm not looking to the past and saying everything in the past is good, everything in the future is terrible. I'm competing. That's why I want to friend you. Please, please friend me back on Facebook. I'm competing for the over 40 category with the most friends on Facebook. I'm going to win the over 40, not over 40 friend, over 40. I'm going to win that category. I'm going. I know it's embarrassing to have a revolution friend, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to win that over 40 category on Facebook. So I understand these things, and you have to adapt, you have to change. But just to constantly seek change, to the freshness of it, and the newness, welcome to mediocrity. Welcome to just lukewarm, average, diffused energy. You'll just walk through life being common at everything, great at nothing. You know a lot about everything. The game show syndrome. I hate and stop yourself when you see someone succeeding on a game show. He's so bright. No! He isn't bright. It's called trivia. And trivia isn't knowledge or wisdom. It's just trivia. If you occupy your mind with trivia. T.S. Eliot, Wasteland, the anthem of the 1930s, people who were looking to change their world in the 30s, saw this poem, T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland. Where, he says, where is the knowledge we've lost in information? Where is the information we've lost in wisdom? Three types of knowledge. Knowledge, information, knowledge, and wisdom in ascending order. The highest form is wisdom. We're so busy pursuing information age, with no knowledge. Because it's all just stupid facts. And then we're so busy amassing knowledge that we lose wisdom. So you may fashion yourself, oh, we're smarter than before, because I know all these facts. These stupid little facts. Don't become a trivia addict. Don't become a trivia victim. Oh, I can win on a game show. I'm bright. No, it kills me. He's not bright. He's not bright. It's a waste. Instead of taking an idea, spinning it, developing it, we have to go to Meyer. Let's go. We'll stop when it dies.
My brother, I've been talking to him a long time.
You're only 15 minutes away.
All right, so. Hey, most of it.
Go ahead, freezing cold.